Welcome to the good, the bad, and the sequel Q&A. My name's Doug. So next week's sequel that we're going to be covering is one of the greatest sequels of all time, according to Jamie. I haven't seen this movie in years, so I'll take his word for it. And that is Superman 2. And we were lucky enough to interview the man who plays Nan in the movie. Doesn't say a word, but his size and presence in this movie is phenomenal. And that is actor, boxer, and author Jack O'Halloran. Man, when I do the research for these people, you know, the movies they're in, it's on IMDb, it's easy. Superman, King Kong, Hero of the Terror, a canon movie classic. He goes toe-to-toe with Chuck Norris, Dragnet, but his boxing career, even people that don't know boxing will know the names when he tells the stories from his boxing career. We talked about growing up outside of Philadelphia and New Jersey and just so much more. And of course, his book, it's called Family Legacy. It talks about his father, Albert Anastasia, Google the name, huge mafia ties in New Jersey, and just the stories that he has to tell about that. So that book, I'll put the link in the notes so you can check that out, but that's familylegacythenovel.com. So I'm going to shut my yapper, but before I start the interview, please subscribe wherever you're listening, wherever on any podcast, please subscribe. It helps us out and rate us, give us some stars. 5 would be great. I'll take anything. So here is actor, boxer, and author Jack O'Halloran. You're a Jersey guy, right?
Well, I was born in Philly, but I lived in New Jersey as well, yeah.
Okay, like that's like Philadelphia, New Jersey, like south of Cherry Hill?
Yeah, they built the Walt Whitman Bridge back in the 50s, late 50s, and everybody ran over to South Jersey, so I actually graduated high school I lived in Belmar off the Black Horse Pike.
Oh, look at that. Is that where Mike Trout's from around that area?
Probably, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, well, awesome, man. Yeah, I'm from like more central Jersey.
What part of Jersey are you from?
South Plainfield, near like Edison.
Oh, yeah, I know where it's at, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I'd like to be able to chat with the folks and find out how they got started and things they did. And obviously, acting was something you did after you had a first love. So how'd you get into boxing?
I was actually playing football. And when I was at that age, you couldn't play. If you played a professional sport, you couldn't play an amateur sport. So I was, and I had to wait for, you had to wait for your class to graduate before you could play pro ball. They didn't have hardship cases where you left out of after 1 year. You had to wait till your class actually graduated. So,
oh, wow.
I was picked up Webb Eubank up in the Jets.
No way.
And when I got eligible to play, I played for a year on what they call like a farm team, semi-pro team for the Jets down in Philly in Tinicum. Jimmy Christie and his brother Dick Christie played there. A lot of guys played while they were waiting to go up into the pros. Anyway, by the time Philadelphia had a hell of a team, and I said I would have wanted to go down and play for Philly when I was eligible. Then Jerry Wallman bought the team, and then he hired some clown, Joe Q. Herrick, and Q. Herrick traded a championship team away in about 2 months. Traded Jurgensen and Tom McDonald or Norman Snead and linebacker. I mean, it was just terrible. So I just said, you know, and Ali had just won the title. And I said, I can beat that guy. And some people say, well, that's a good idea. And they put me in the gym in South Philly. And so I never boxed amateur. I just went right into the pros.
Whoa. How long did you train before your first fight?
About 5 months.
Oh, wow.
I had to come down. I weighed about, when I was playing ball, I weighed around 280. So they brought me all the way down to like 230.
Damn. So you had a pretty good start to your career. You started off 16-0. What did it feel like the first time that you had like a knockout? What was that feeling?
It's just like old school. I never lost a fight in the street in my life. So was just like walking down the street, you know. I had my first fight, I think it was in Reading, Pennsylvania. I knocked a guy out in 76 seconds or something.
Damn. Jack, I'm pretty surprised that anybody would mess with you growing up at six. You're 6'6", right?
Yeah, 6'6".
I feel bad for the guy that tried to pick on you.
Well, you know, I just, it was a, well, you know, we come up in the streets in Philly, you know, it was a tough neighborhood. So it's land of survival.
Yeah.
I had some pretty good teachers when I was a kid. So, I had some good people around me. But, and boxing, I was undefeated, and then the doctors did some physical thing. They found out that I had a disease called acromegaly, which is a tumor of the pituitary, and they told me I shouldn't be fighting at all.
Oh,
and
wow.
I said, and I just kept on going. It didn't bother me. I didn't care. And then finally, it did. In the end, I had to get it fixed. I went to San Diego, and when I won the California heavyweight title, I stayed in San Diego and had to fight Norton and stayed there. And the doctor and I became good friends, and he said, either you go to Scripps and get a workup or I'm pulling your boxing license because this disease will kill you. And I said, yeah, okay. So I went, and they said it was pretty, pretty active. And so I wound up going to the Mass General and having it fixed. And then I retired from boxing, and I had turned down movies like three or four times when Steve McQueen was doing the Thomas Crown Affair in Boston. He wanted me to quit boxing and come in the movie business with him.
Wow.
He was pretty good friends, and I passed. And then I just knocked out Manuel Ramos in L.A. in 68, and they offered me the Great White Hope. And I turned it down with James Earl Jones because I figured I was up for a title fight. And they wanted me to go to Spain for 6 months. So I said, I don't think so. So I turned that down. And then they offered me Farewell, My Lovely with Robert Mitchum. And I said, well, I think it's probably about time. So it's all Mitchum's fault.
It's pretty wild that while you were doing that, these people were like, hey, we want you to be in this movie, especially like a guy like Steve McQueen. And you're like, no, I want to keep doing it because you love what you were doing.
Steve was a good guy. He and I got on really well.
That's cool.
We looked after him in Boston when he was doing Thomas Crown Affair. And he said, you got to come to Hollywood. And then when I was out here and I turned down the Great White Hope, he called me on the phone. He said, what is wrong with you? He said, we want you to come to Hollywood. Blah, blah, blah. I said, nah, not ready yet. So then when I did Farewell, My Lovely, it all seemed to click together, and it was good.
That's awesome. And then from there, everything kind of took off from there.
We did King Kong and Jessica Lange, and then the Superman movies came out, and was turning down movies in between. They wanted me to do a film with Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, which I should have done. I had a break period in King Kong, and they wanted me to go up and do this Silver Streak.
Oh, yeah.
I turned down like six pictures. Richard Kiel got them, and that was his career. So it worked out okay. It was all right.
Let's talk like a little bit of Superman. So you get the first Superman role. Were you like you're a tough guy, football boxer. Were you like a fan of like Superman, the TV show or the comics at all?
Jackie Gleason was a friend of mine, and he did the picture called Zhigo and won an Oscar. And I said, if I ever get a chance to do a role where I can use facial and body language, I want to do it. So Nan was a perfect character because you had Sarah was a man-eater and Terrence was a vicious general. Somebody had to relate to the children because of a big children audience. And so I played this really brutish, vicious guy like a child, learning how to lose my eyes and stuff like that. And it worked very well.
That's so cool. And then, obviously, they shot a lot of the second one. Well, that was the plan to use a lot of that second movie. What was it like working with like Richard Donner? And then,
it was like night and day. I mean, Donner was a brilliant director. Richard was like a television director, it was very sad because if they would have let Donner finish two, because he had already done like 86% of it. If they had let him finish two, he would have done three, four, and five, would have been a different franchise.
I bet, definitely.
Times were, it was very foolish what they did. They had come up with 20 excuses, but they didn't want to pay people. So they owed Lester a picture. So they they got him for cheaper than what Donner was there for, I guess. And I mean, I blame Christopher. Christopher should have turned around and said, you know what? No Donner, no me.
Yeah.
And because Hackman never came back. Hackman said, you know, no Donner, no me. So they worked around that. And, you know, because we had shot so much footage already, which we were shooting one and two together. Actually, we got cooked into two. We had to stop so we could get one out so they could get the first film out.
What's that like on set with like you and the other actors, like knowing like the big changes happened? There's got to be some kind of like...
Well, it wasn't. Some people weren't happy, but, you know, the other people just, that's the film industry, so... You know, you just got on with your job. And you know, Superman 2 didn't turn out all that bad. Just it had a little bit more comedy. But I liked the Donner cut much better.
Yeah, no, definitely. So how was it like working with all those actors? You had like Brando, Hackman, Christopher Reeve, Ned Beatty, Jackie Cooper, like all these heavyweights.
Well, Christopher was his first movie.
Yeah.
So he was like a, you know, kid coming out of the ballpark. And but, you know, I was second film I'd done with Hackman, and Brando was great. Brando and I got on really well. And,
oh, that's cool.
And, you know, we had a great, I mean, you worked 3 years with a crew of people. Valerie Perrine was great. Terrence Stamp is a great actor. Sarah's a very good actor. We had a great crew. I mean, the cast was brilliant. All the way down to, you know, the cameos. There was a lot of great actors that were involved. So we had a good time. It was like old home week, you know?
Yeah, especially like you said, 3 years is not much to do. You're on that for most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, Margot Kidder was super. You know, we had a lot of fun together. We ate a lot of dinners together. We hung out together. It was good.
Where was that mostly filmed?
In London.
Oh, nice. How was that?
It was good. You know, we worked out of Pinewood Studios. Most of it was done there. There was some done in San Francisco, a little bit done in Canada, but most of it was done in England.
You fought over there a few times. Were you recognized when you were like out at the pub or out to dinner?
Oh, yeah. No, I had some good fights over in England. Wow.
That's awesome. So, yeah, so that, those are some cool Superman stories. And that's like a role of a, you know, that movie is going to stand the test of time forever.
We broke a lot of technology rules when we did Superman. I mean, the flying shots were brilliant. And they, you know, we shot VistaVision on VistaVision. It was better than CGI, and it worked really well. Very long and tedious, but it worked extremely well.
That's awesome. So in the 80s, you had some like guest starring roles on a lot of shows. Was there any role that you had after Superman that you'd say is like your favorite role that you had over the years?
I like Dragnet.
Yeah,
you know, nice. When I did the Dragnet movie with Tom Hanks and Dan Aykroyd film, and I did a film with Chuck Norris, which was probably the best film that he ever did. And I did a great little movie called Baltimore Bullet with Omar Sharif and Jimmy Coburn.
Oh, nice.
Which was a pool shooting picture. It's sad that they didn't have the money to publicize it probably, because it was a pretty good movie.
What movie was that with Chuck Norris?
Hero and the Terror.
Oh, cool. I got to check that out.
Yeah, Hero and the Terror is not a bad film.
So yeah, then you were in like Diagnosis Murder, and then you had a role in the Flintstones movie, and then you took some time off.
Well, I wrote a book, and I, you know, I went to England, and I lived on the Isle of Man, and I lived in Ireland, and I lived in the Isle of Man, and I wrote a book called Family Legacy.
Oh, cool. Which
we're getting ready to make a movie out of. And
no way.
Yeah, we got 3 more books coming out. It's a great book. Actually did very well. So it's...
Is it a biography about your career, or...?
I had a very famous father. My father was Albert Anastasia, who was partners with Charlie Luciano and Frank Costello and Meyer Lansky. And was probably the most feared Italian ever come in the country. He ran a little company called Murder, Inc. And then he was, the Gambino family was the Anastasia family. And my father was assassinated in 57, then Gambino was his underboss and it became the Gambino family.
Whoa. So growing up, did you know all of this or did you find out later in life?
Well, I, you know, when I was about 14 years old, my father was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
I was raised by guys like Meyer Lansky and Charlie, you know, Frank Costello. So I knew a lot about him. Yeah.
Wow.
North Jersey. I spent a lot of time in North Jersey, Montclair.
Oh, really? Okay. I'm not too far from there, but yeah, look at that. Wow. That's unbelievable. So, how is the, that's pretty cool. So you're going to like produce the movie or you're going to, is there a director or anybody attached?
We're putting it all together right now. It's going to be, it'll be bigger than The Godfather. We're telling the true story about a lot of things and the book's a great book. And, you know, if people want, they just go to familylegacythenovel.com and it's, everything's right there.
So yeah, I have the link for, Amazon. So I'll put both of them into the notes and when I put it out there, so people can check it out, I have a Kindle, so I'm going to get it on Kindle and check it out. That's pretty cool.
That's a great read. You'll enjoy the read. It's a good read.
So what'd you like about like the whole writing process?
I have a great script that I wrote called, Ballad of a Simple Man, which is The Old Informer, which was done by John Ford back in the '30s. And we're getting ready to do that in Ireland. And I wrote that about 40 years ago. So writing seemed to come kind of easy for me. I have a ghostwriter in England that I do books with, and I talk, he writes. You know, we put it together. I give him all the outlines and everything, and stuff that I want to do, and where I want to take it, and between the two of us, it works out pretty good.
So, were you able to? So, when you're doing a lot of research on this, was that like? I'm sure you learned a lot when you know when your father.
Well, the research is. Was my own living experience. And when I sent the ghostwriter to libraries to look certain things up, he was amazed that that the public didn't know it. He said, it's all there in black and white. How could people not know this? And so we just filled in a lot of blanks and told a lot of truth about things. So the first book is from my father's death to the Kennedy assassination. And I tell the truth about the Kennedy assassination. And there's a lot of true story. It's like they just came out with this picture of The Irishman, which is total bullshit. I knew Frank Sheeran very well. He's from Philadelphia. And I knew Russell Buffalino very well. He was a good friend of my father's. And Russell was from Buffalo originally. And Frank Sheeran never killed Hoffa, and he never killed Joe Gallo. So what they did was they took advantage of the public because all these things are hanging in the air. Everybody's been waiting for answers for it. So they answered questions, but they didn't answer them correctly. So they did a Hollywood advantage deal. So we're going to tell the truth about a lot of things that happened and how, you know, what people don't understand is that in the beginning, the government, industry, unions and organized crime were all partners for a lot of years. You know, the illicit monies that they made through gambling and loan sharking and extortion, they put back into the public. They put back into society. They made sure people had jobs. My father ran all the waterfronts, and so they ran the unions, and they had the construction unions, and they had steel workers, and a lot of revenue stream they put back to the growth of a country, and nobody ever talks about that. Wow. So we're going to tell the truth about a lot of it, you know.
That'll be cool. So when's like a time frame that you want to be able to get that out there?
This year. We're going to have the film will be out this year. We're very close to buttoning down all the points of it now and getting ready to roll. Once we roll, you know, the film will be done, the television will be done because they'll both complement each other. And then the other books will come out one after the other every 6 months. And, you know, we'll do a film off of each book.
That's awesome. And how are you going to release the film? Or is it going to be like a wide release or like a streaming service?
It'll be a wide, wide release.
That's so cool, man. Good for you. That's really neat.
Yeah. Very excited.
It's so funny. Like a lot of times you see people in a movie or like, you know, you and your boxing career, and you don't know a lot of these stories just by looking at that. So that's pretty fascinating. So are the other books already written?
Pretty much. You know, the outlines are all done. We know where we're going with them, you know, and so it's, you know, we're just going to take different periods of time and fill in a lot of the blanks, you know.
Yeah, I'll check out for them, and I'll definitely read the book that's out now, Family Legacy. One thing I have to ask you, and I was looking at all your like bios on different websites, it's pretty cool. You're in the NJ Boxing Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I was in California Hall of Fame, but New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and New England. Yeah.
So one thing I read on there was you got a. Is that true? You got a phone call from Muhammad Ali?
Yeah, Ali and I were good friends, and he was he had moved into Cherry Hill. He bought a house in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
No way.
And he was with a guy called Gene Kilroy. Was the guy that was around him a lot. And they called me from the car, and he said, you have to do me a favor. And I said, yeah, well, I'll do you a favor, sign a contract to fight me. He said, yeah, we'll work that out. He said, but you're fighting my brother Rockman. Get him out of boxing. He's, you know. So I said, Rockman Ali's your brother? And he said, yeah. So I was fighting him in San Diego. I said, oh, shit, I better go in the gym a couple of days. Knocked his brother out. He never fought again. I knocked him out. Then he and I were supposed to, when he fought Norton, he was supposed to fight me. But that's another story. We were all signed and everything. We had a deal put together. But Norton was owned by some very wealthy people, you know, Bob Byron and Art Rifkin. And they took $3 million and went to Chicago, and they gave it to Herb Muhammad. And Ali called me on the phone. He was crying, actually. He said, I don't know how to tell you this, but, you know, I don't have any control over it. So. And he fought Norton in San Diego. And then we were supposed to fight in Australia when he fought Bugner. And then we were supposed to fight another time somewhere. But it just never seemed to materialize for one reason or another.
Were you friends with anyone else that you fought? I wonder how that is, like being friends with somebody and then going in the ring and trying to knock their brains in.
It's a sport.
Yeah, no, I know.
I was friends with a lot of guys I fought, but, you know, there was very few that I really disliked that much. Foreman and I were good friends, you know. Norton and I were good friends, you know.
And you fought Norton, right?
I beat Norton in San Diego. They gave him a decision, and he knew it. And they would never fight me again. In fact, I could have sat on a stool in the ninth round and won the fight. The ninth round, it was a great fight. He and I had a brilliant fight. And, you know, people were standing on the chairs screaming so loud that when they rang the bell at the end of the ninth round, nobody could hear it. They rang it twice, three times, finally separated us. And I was going back to my corner. He ran across the ring and hit me behind the head.
Oh, my God.
Into the ring post. And the commissioner, Joey Almas, jumped up in the corner and said, if you can't continue, you just won the fight. And I was angry. I said, continue. I'm going to kill this clown. And I should have realized I'm in San Diego, his hometown. But I won the town over, right? You know, the people, I stayed there and I won the California title. And I beat a guy, Henry Clark, that nobody wanted to fight from San Francisco. He was a pretty good fighter.
I'm sure you got to fight, obviously, in front of your home crowd. But what was it like? Like you said, you fought him in his hometown. I'm sure you fought somebody that was English when you fought in England. What is that like going into enemy territory?
I had a lot of friends in London, you know. So I and Bugner, the Bugner fight was a joke. I mean, I had Bugner out on his feet. I was supposed to be a 10. We fought at Albert Hall, and we were the headline. So it was a 10-round fight, supposedly.
Yeah.
And Mickey Duff stopped it at the end of the eighth round. I remember when the bell rang and they said, well, that's it. The fight's over. I said, what are you talking about? We had two more rounds to go. He said, no, fight's over. Eighth round, boom, eight-round fight. And they stole a quarter of a point. No one ever heard of this before in England. Bugger won the fight by a quarter of a point.
Oh, my gosh.
It was a trip. But he... And he would never fight me, guys. And I beat Carl Gizzy, and I beat Danny McElinden. So I beat some pretty good people in the Grosvenor House. Carl Gizzy was a champ of Wales, and he was a hell of a fighter. And Danny McElinden was the British Empire champion, and he was undefeated. So I beat him in the Grosvenor House. It was good.
Jack, this has been awesome, and I'll make sure that I send people and people I know, I'll definitely tell them to check out Family Legacy, because, you know, being in Jersey, like, that's a big thing, you know, the mafia, the mob, people love
it. I was raised amongst all of them up in North York, and, you know, there were better times when they ran the streets, I'll tell you, you know, I'd often tell people that's when, you know, when I was a kid and raised in Philadelphia, we never locked our front doors.
No, I'm sure. You know,
Neighborhoods were a lot safer. Kids played in the street from sun up to sundown. Nobody ever bothered anybody. You know, drive-by shootings, stuff like that. And, you know, when neighborhoods were controlled by people, they were a lot safer.
Yeah. You
know? A lot different way of life. But, you know, it is what it is, so. A lot of changes in our society, unfortunately.
No, I know, definitely. But that's cool. I don't want you to spoil anything. You mentioned the JFK assassination, but that's in this book, the first book?
Yeah.
All right, cool. I don't want you to spoil it on here, but I'll definitely check that out. I'm fascinated with the whole JFK and everything, that all the theories and everything that comes around it. So I can't wait to see what...
So much malarkey that they... that they spread around and stuff, and you know, you just have to, if you understood the time, if you were there during that time, and I was in Dallas, so I was, I was at the party the night before at Clint Murchison Jr.'s house.
Really?
And I was there on the premise that I was going to play football for the Dallas Cowboys because he owned the Cowboys, but Meyer Lansky had set up because he wanted me to go there. It was a learning exercise to see who was there. And I met a lot of very, very influential people that night. It was a learning experience, but it's for damn sure.
That's wild that you were there.
Yeah, the night before I was there. I was there the following morning, and they got me out of town. But that's in the book. And people have this fixation as to how Kennedy died and who killed him and stuff like that. And, you know, you have to look at things in a very open-minded. If you were going to blame one person for Jack Kennedy's death, you'd have to look at his father. I mean, his father would rather see him die the way he died than to die from a sickness. And Jack he wouldn't have lived out his term. He was dying of four different diseases. They used to shoot him up every day. He was dying of Addison's disease, which is a total deterioration of your spinal cord. He had syphilis and two other diseases. So he was not in great physical shape. And, when he went to Texas, he should never have even went down there the way he did with an open car and stuff. And four people had went to see his brother. And, you know, when you say who was the number one cop in the country when Kennedy got killed, and everybody thinks it was Hoover. It wasn't Hoover. It was his brother. It was the attorney general. And four people went to see him, one of them, Adlai Stevenson, and said, do not let your brother go to Texas. The animosity down there is horrendous. They were down and they were spitting at me in Houston, and it's just not a good time to go there. And then to go there in an open car, you know, was... So there was a lot of things that happened that day that were big flag raisers that nobody ever, you know, really took a look at. So, you know, I like Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a great politician. It's just unfortunate his father had a lot of control over him. It made a lot of people very angry, you know. So when you sit down and say, who was the actual person who killed him? Everybody blamed the mafia, and it wasn't them. They were there were four factions of people who had animosities that you could blame it on. But the biggest animosity was from Europe because of what Joe Kennedy did during the crash and hurt a lot of people.
Wow.
And they never forgot it. And, you know, and the bankers of Geneva were kind of unforgiving people. So they orchestrated something. It took them a while to orchestrate it, but they did what they did. You know, and when you look at it, you know, the whole Oswald thing was total bull. Oswald never killed Kennedy. Kennedy was shot three times that day, And that took 10 years or 15 years before all that came out. First shot hit him in the throat when he grabbed his throat and he fell forward. First shot that was fired, I think, 13 shots fired that day. First one hit Conley, and Conley fell, and then Jack fell on top of Conley. And then he got shot in his lower back, and they never talked about that. And then the third shot, the driver turned around and shot him, and you see Kennedy fly backwards.
Oh, wow.
The back of his head comes out. Now, you can't do that shot from a window from behind him.
Even the shots from the window, I don't know if you ever watched, I know you know Jesse Ventura, but he had a show, and he tried to reenact it, and he is like I don't know what military term it is, but he's like a sharpshooter from his time in the military. And he couldn't like even come close to landing those shots. And Oswald wasn't a good shot.
I'll give you a very simple analogy. Yeah. Number one, the rifle that was used was store-bought. It was a mail order. Okay. And it was a bolt action rifle. Okay. Now you're shooting anybody who knows anything about rifles or shooting at all. There's where Jesse was very, very accurate on. If you're shooting a shot of 1,000 yards and you're shooting it in Dealey Plaza, the wind was terrible down there. In fact, it was so bad that the microphones on the police cars, nobody could hear them or anything because it was a derelict. It was a wind tunnel there. So you have trees, signs, a vehicle that's going on a downgrade. In moving, and you have wind. So for you as a marksman, shooting a shot of 1,000 feet like that, you have to A, arrest your heartbeat because your pulse is in your finger. So it takes you 60 seconds to get yourself arrested properly and to take the shot, period. All right. So to say that you shot 3 bolt action shots in 28 seconds is totally ludicrous.
Yeah.
All somebody did was make a noise out of the window. And the window, there was 3 people standing in that window, 2 of them dark-complected. And there was a jail directly across from there. You understand? And these guys were looking right in that window. Oswald wasn't even in the window. And you have a president of the United States in an open car below on the street below the Bird Building there, and the windows are all open and people are moving all around, and you have the President of the United States. That Secret Service should never have allowed that at all. Period.
Yeah, I bet you if you look back, I'm sure they never did that with a president before that. I wonder why.
Well, they never would. It's not protocol. And then to have all those guys coming off the train or walking over the bridge where the car was going underneath. You understand?
Yeah.
And they were, one of them was Woody Harrelson's father, who was a hitman for New Orleans.
Some guy told us that. Me and my wife, we moved from Jersey to Oregon, and then we moved back since then. But we stopped in Dallas, and a guy that we paid $5 for some newspaper he had, he told us a story. And when he mentioned Woody Harrelson's dad, I was like, what? But no, that's crazy.
Was a hitman for Carlos Marcellus out of New Orleans. In fact, there were 13 people there that could have killed anybody. And you had the first shot that hit Kennedy came from a cauldron alongside the street, which they have since cemented in. And the cauldron went from the river to the street, and it was big enough for me to walk down. You understand?
That's big.
The tunnel, in other words, I could walk down it. And Johnny Roselli took the first shot from there to hit Kennedy in the throat.
That's wild.
And I know that for a fact. And, so it's it's the whole Warren Commission was total bullshit. You know, they spent all that time on the Warren Commission, all that stuff, and when they grabbed Jack Ruby and they sat him down for the Warren Commission, and the first thing the guy Ruby said to them was, I guess you wanted me to tell you about Chicago and stuff. They said no. And he said, well, you can't question me here. You got to get me out of Dallas. This is not a good place to do this. And they shot him up with cancer. He died in jail 6 months later, died of cancer. Wow. And when you see Oswald, they never taped one interview with him. They never wrote anything down. And when he came out into the garage with the sheriff and the other guy alongside of him, you see the footage, the guy steps away from him. as Ruby comes up to shoot him.
That's insane. I've seen that so many times. I have to watch it again as soon as we're done.
Just watch how the guy steps away from him.
I will.
And like almost pushes him in line of getting shot.
Oh, wow.
And the fact that Ruby even got into the place with a gun on him was amazing.
That is true, yeah. I don't know how they would let it go.
The whole 9 yards is bullshit. You know, when you turn around and you look at all the componentries and the pieces, and then you got to look at the animosities that were put in place. You know, there was a lot of things that went on that made a lot of people very unhappy. And, you know, you had all the oil guys down there, they had what they called surplus oil that they sold on the market, and they never paid tax on it. So they made a lot of money from it. And when Jack Kennedy was elected president, one of the first things his father said to him was, you have to levy a tax on those wealthy guys down there in Texas on this surplus oil. And that cost them over, you know, $100, $200 million a year. So they weren't too happy about all that. And a lot of things that were not, a lot of animosities went on down there. So, you know, you had a lot of finger pointing to do. And, you know, people, it wasn't such a simple deal as what they made it out to be, that Oswald took a shot and killed the president. That's all bullshit. But people bought it.
Oh, no,
I know. The power of the media, what the media did, and, you know, the way they played it up, and the whole Warren Commission and everything. You know, it's just, and the Warren Commission is written by a bunch of Yaleys.
Crazy. Well, I have some reading to do, definitely. But yeah, so I can't wait to be able to see the movie when it comes out, and then the books that come out after that, and then the more films you're going to make. So, Jack, thanks so much for taking the time. This has been awesome.
Hey, it's my pleasure, man.
All right, man.
Take care.
We'll keep in touch.
All right. Be well.
Man, wasn't Jack mind-blowing? We did this interview a while back, just before the pandemic, and listening back, oh my God, I was mind-blown. My jaw was on the floor once again when it came to his stories about JFK and being there the night before, so he was going to play for the Cowboys. Ugh. And just his stories about Superman, the set. Man, Jack was a great guy. Again, his book is Family Legacy, the novel. And you could check that out at familylegacythenovel.com. I'll put that in the episode notes so you could check it out. And now, don't forget your homework. Oh. Your homework is so much fun. Superman 2, one of the greatest sequels of all time. It was the last great one in the franchise. Canon bought the rights to it. 3 and 4 were all over the place. Still fun movies to watch. So you got to do that. And don't forget to review, rate, share our podcast. Follow us on all social media at Sequels Only. And don't forget to check out our website, sequelsonly.com. Good night.